It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Since 2004, the amount of radon present in Pennsylvania air has steadily increased, an increase that our guest, Dr. Joan Casey, says began the same year that the state's first fracking sites became operational. Dr. Casey recently published her findings that quantify Pennsylvania radon levels, and she joins us to discuss the possible cause of its decade-long spike, as well as what Pennsylvania residents can do to protect themselves from the toxic gas, the second leading cause of lung cancer nationwide. Joan Casey, how has the amount of radon in Pennsylvania air changed from 2004 to the present?
Since 2004, we've seen the levels of radon statewide increase. And then we've also seen in counties that have had more of the unconventional natural gas development that radon levels have increased more quickly than in those counties without any development.
What are the differences in radon from county to county or even town by town? What specific factors seem to indicate a higher level of the gas?
A lot of factors are associated with radon levels. The biggest one is going to be the amount of uranium in the soil underneath the buildings, because the main way that radon gets into buildings and homes is by, it's a gas, and it diffuses from underneath the home and then gets trapped in the basement where people can be exposed. But radon can also be found in water because it can dissolve in water. So if you're showering, radon can get into the home. And then radon has also been found in natural gas. And so some things that we've looked at that might impact indoor radon levels are things like the type of building in which you live. Like I said, that uranium in the soil, by county, it can be very different just depending on the bedrock underlaying the buildings. And then even things like season, rainfall, well water use, those things can influence radon levels as well. And the new thing that we were looking at in this study, of course, was whether living near a lot of unconventional natural gas development could be related to indoor radon levels.
How would you know if you have a problem with radon levels on your property, in your home? Are there any particular telltale signs, or is it just something that people have to get checked?
That's an important point, because radon is colorless, it's odorless, but it's also this carcinogenic gas. And so it is important for people in Pennsylvania to be checking their indoor radon levels, because we know that historically Pennsylvania has had a lot of radon, and there are potentially new pathways opening up due to this industry.
And how is radon harmful to the body? What does it cause, and over what period of time?
We know that radon is carcinogenic. It can cause lung cancer. We found that out a long time ago because uranium miners who were really exposed to radon gas would come down with lung cancer at much greater rates than average people. So that's the main health risk that we know about from radon, that lung cancer risk.
And what level of radon would have to exist in a person's breathing air in order to cause any health problems?
The Environmental Protection Agency sets this action level at 4 picocuries per liter. So that's kind of the level that above which you want to do something about the radon levels in the home, because the EPA is saying that that could potentially be a health risk.
And if you could just clarify for us, Dr. Casey, what are picocuries?
Picocuries are just a unit that we measure radon in. And so we just know that a higher level of that is associated with more radon in the home. Since radon is a gas, it's per liter a volumetric measure.
And how can we figure out what's really causing the excess of radon? What tests need to be completed?
Yeah, I should mention, so we saw radon levels increasing statewide from 2004 to 2013, but we can't be sure that that's due to unconventional natural gas development. There could be something else that changed during that same time period that also could lead to radon levels going up. For instance, if buildings in the state were more tightly sealed over that time, we might also see levels increasing over time because the radon gas couldn't escape. So ideally, we would keep tracking radon levels in buildings, and we'd also want to continue measuring, which the Department of Environmental Protection, the state, has done at a few wells, measure levels at the unconventional wells themselves, take ambient air samples, look at what's in the natural gas, look at what's in the wastewater coming back from drilling, and then try to link that over time to what's happening in buildings. So we need more detailed studies that know more about the buildings themselves and also about these wells.
Does natural gas contain more radon than conventional gas?
That depends. It can. Studies have shown that gas coming out of shale formations can contain elevated levels of radon, but it really depends. It can be a well-by-well difference. It can also differ by state.
And how does radon enter homes, and how does it become entrapped?
The main way that radon enters homes is by diffusing up from the soil beneath the building into the basement. And if there's no way for that radon to get out, it can actually just get trapped and held there in the basement where people can then get exposed. There's a couple other ways that radon gets into homes. Radon can diffuse into water and dissolve into water. And so if water is used in the home just through showering or hand washing and whatnot, radon can then get into the house. And then finally, radon has been found in natural gas. So if natural gas is being used for cooking in the home, that's another potential pathway. But the main way that we've looked at radon getting into homes in the past has been that diffusion from the soil beneath.
To your knowledge, is this happening in any other areas of the country? Are any other states experiencing a similar increase?
While studies haven't been done, it probably is important also to look at this in Colorado, because Colorado also historically has had pretty high indoor radon levels, and they also have a lot of unconventional natural gas development. And so I think a few preliminary looks have been done in that state, but a more full statewide study would be good to see there. But to my knowledge, there aren't any other studies that have looked at this issue in the United States.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Dr. Joan Casey, who has done a study on radon for the state of Pennsylvania. How can families test for radon in their homes? What can be done to lessen the amounts of radon in residential homes that are found to have high levels of it?
There are a couple ways radon can be tested. If you're a homeowner, you can just go out and buy a kit, and you set that up in your home, usually in the basement, and you'll test radon levels. That'll go to a laboratory. You'll get results back. You can also hire, the state has licensed radon professionals that can come in and take those measurements for you. And then radon remediation generally consists of increasing airflow to the outside of the house so that radon can escape. It's not incredibly expensive, and it's definitely worthwhile because this gas can be dangerous.
Dr. Joan Casey, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Glad to do it.
Coming up, what can you do to monitor air quality in your home? The answer may be in your local library.
Well, I think people are just very interested in air quality in the Pittsburgh area, and I think they're interested in the air quality in their homes.
Our look at air quality continues on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. From books to workshops to internet access, libraries are an integral part of any community. Over the past few months, Carnegie Library's Squirrel Hill branch has seen an item you might not expect to become a hit with patrons. A recent city paper article states the 10 small indoor air quality monitors have been harder to check out than a New York Times bestseller, end quote. Joining us by phone to tell us more about this is Jody Bell, Library Services Manager at the Squirrel Hill Branch. Jody Bell, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. How did your branch end up obtaining the air quality monitors for, if you'll pardon the words, circulation?
Well, it was a partnership with Carnegie Mellon, and actually our head of technology, Toby Greenwalt, was the person that coordinated this, and I just worked in conjunction with Toby and the folks from CMU to get these monitors in our branch and start circulating them. So that's how we ended up with them.
And is there a waiting list to check them out?
Well, we don't have them. You cannot hold the devices. You can just come in, and if they're available, that's how you get them. We do not have holds on these devices.
Why do you think that they've been so popular?
Well, I think people are just very interested in air quality in the Pittsburgh area, and I think they're interested in the air quality in their homes. I also think that people are curious and want to do a little bit of citizen science and see what's happening in their own households.
And what kinds of comments have you been hearing from the patrons who've been checking out the air monitors?
Well, I think they find them very interesting, and they're kind of looking at what's happening in their houses when they make changes. I've actually know of somebody that was doing some construction work in their home, and they were curious about what stuff they were kicking up in their house as far as, you know, removing carpeting and taking down walls. So they wanted to know at that point what the air quality was.
Have people said anything to you about what they might be concerned about in their homes, the kinds of things that might be compromising the quality of their air?
Well, you know, I don't work the front lines very often, but many of my staff have talked to customers about this, and they haven't gotten specific on what they're looking for. Like I said, the person doing construction, I know that there is a business downtown that actually wanted one because of construction happening in their area, not necessarily in their building, but next to their building. So I think they're just looking for what is in the air.
Have you ever thought about checking out one of these things yourself?
I have had it in my office, and my air quality is good in my office.
Well, we're glad to hear that.
Yes.
How much longer will the air monitors be available at the library?
Well, we're actually working with CMU to get additional monitors. It's in the works, and hopefully we'll get some more at our branch and then make them available at other locations.
Jody Bell, Library Services Manager at the Squirrel Hill Branch of the Carnegie Library, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. I'm joined now by Carnegie Mellon University robotics professor, Dr. Ela Norbash, and also B. Dias, who does all of the outreach work for the CREATE Lab at CMU, which is responsible for the air quality monitors. The Carnegie Libraries have received these monitors. Can measure air quality in a person's home. They can also measure air quality in our new studio here at the Community Broadcast Center. Pantechnicon, as I like to call it. Dr. Norbash, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on this, and congratulations on the new studio.
Thank you. We're going to measure the air quality in the studio here. In fact, it's being measured right now, and we'll get to that. I think that's of less concern to the general population than things you're going out in the community and measuring. And B. Dias, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you very much. Doing fine.
So you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. We'd like to hear from you. What concerns do you have about the air quality in your home in Pittsburgh, which has been cited as one of the major American cities that does not have the best air quality? So that's where these air quality monitors really come into play. 412-246-2002, the number to call. 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. So, Dr. Norbash, how does the air quality monitor work?
Sure. The air quality monitor, we call it a spec. It has a little fan on the bottom, and it pulls in the air in your living room or dining room, wherever you put it, and it shines light on the air and looks at how the light reflects. And by looking at that reflection, you can actually count how many ultrafine particles there are in the air. These are the things that are so tiny. They're much smaller than a red blood cell there.
So I'm looking at the apparatus right now, and it looks about the size of like an egg timer, we'll say, except that it's much more sophisticated because it's an electronic device. It's got sort of a white outer casing and then a monitor in the middle, and a number is flashing, and I'm seeing 696, 695. It's going between 696 now and 693. So what is that measuring?
That's measuring in particles per liter how many tiny particles between 0.5 microns and 3 microns there are in the air. And these tiny particles matter because as you breathe, These are the particles that are so small that they're what we call particulate air pollution. They go into our lungs, diffuse right into our blood, and they've been directly correlated to arrhythmia, to cardiovascular disease, and, of course, to asthma, which is a major problem in the children in our region.
So we're seeing 660 particulates of pollutants in our air right now in this studio.
Yeah, 660 little tiny particles per liter. Now,
Need to move to a new studio?
Actually, that's a pretty good reading.
Okay, so the air's good then.
That's right. I think moderate. It says moderate on there, so that's really not as bad as my house. My house in Squirrel Hill easily reads 1,000 to 2,000. And when there's an inversion layer, I can easily read several thousand.
Oh, okay. So if someone says, you know, how's your new studio? I can safely say not bad in a number of ways. B, you've been doing the outreach for this. We've heard about, of course, the library having these. Where else have you been putting these air quality monitors?
Well, we just started a spin-off company to sell these specs. So we've shipped out about 60 of them so far. And before that, we were using the previous prototype, and we gave out about 300 to different community groups all across the U.S.
And can it detect radon gas? I mean, this is the thing that we're really concerned about, as we discussed with our earlier guest. This is an odorless gas. You can't smell it. You can't see it. You can't taste it. So this would be something that this device, it would be very important for people to have something that would detect it. Can it detect radon gas?
Not currently.
Yeah, unfortunately, it can't. There's three things people really need to be worried about. One is radon. And luckily, the remediation for that's pretty easy. You have to ventilate your basement. The other one is VOCs, volatile organic compounds, things that are like benzene. And a lot of those are associated with things like natural gas fracking and industry.
Mm. And benzene you can smell.
You can. I think you can smell benzene.
It's kind of a sort of an ammonia type smell.
That's right.
Unfortunately, I was somewhere near a benzene spill in the state of Wisconsin when a train carrying it derailed. So it was pretty bad.
And if you can smell it, it's way bad, because even in parts per billion, benzene's carcinogenic and toxic to humans. And then
we were ordered off of a golf course as a result of that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's our experience with it. Anyway.
And then the third thing is what this measures, which is neither the volatiles and it's also not the radon, but what this measures is the particulates, which is basically the small particles that cause things like asthma and cardiovascular disease.
This is the typical pollution we would find in a place like Pittsburgh.
Because of the highways.
Industrial pollution.
That's right. The Shenango Coke Works, steel works, highways, manufacturing plants, and things like vacuuming or cooking at home with a low cooking temperature oil that causes a lot of smoke to go throughout the house.
We have a lot of people who are interested in talking to Ela and to B. So let's go to the phones at 412-246-2002, starting with John in Squirrel Hill. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Very good. Good morning. I just have a comment on air in hotel rooms.
Now, air in hotel rooms.
I have stayed in a few, you know, we've all stayed in a few hotels in our lives. And these now, that the modern hotels they're nice looking, but they're totally sealed. The air in the room, there's no fresh air coming into the room. And, you know, and the cleaning lady comes every day and sprays. And these are volatiles. These are highly toxic. And after 6 months of spraying, you know, you're done. This room is a fume trap. You know what I mean?
But John, you bring up go ahead.
I've seen a number of hotels in and around Pittsburgh that keep their air very, very good. Can I mention a few of the good ones?
Well, I think what we should focus on are the bad ones that you mentioned earlier, and what we can do. You brought up something very interesting that a lot of us might not have thought of, but this device has been developed at CMU it's a portable device. So, Dr. Norbash, you could take this to your hotel, and if someone like John was concerned about whether you might base your desire to stay in a hotel on the air quality in the room. So you might just take this with you. And at what point would you decide, you know what, I don't want to stay in this room?
Absolutely. You know, I've taken this device with me traveling. And actually, hospitals are another good place to understand what the air quality is. It's a place where you want to control for health, and the last thing you want is particles flowing through the hospital. And in fact, we've even had people, commuters, put this in their car and go through the Liberty tubes. And actually, they've tweeted pictures of how high the number gets when you're stuck in a traffic jam in the middle of the tubes.
So what's a high number? What's a number we should be worried about?
Well, in terms of counts, if you go up to, say, the yellow range, over 1,000, 2,000, then you're going to be concerned, particularly if it's sustained at that level for a few minutes. If it's just a short peak, you're less worried because it could be from dusting your sheets or vacuuming your carpet. And those tend to be larger particles and they're heavier, so they'll settle in the air faster. So you'll see a short blip as opposed to a sustained peak.
I remember seeing the tweet of the picture of the number, and I don't remember what it was, registering in the Liberty tubes. It was how much?
Oh, I don't remember.
I think it was probably 10 times this number. And it was in a different 6, unit.
6,000?
Well, we do counts and then we do micrograms, two different units. So you can switch between them by pressing on the screen.
Okay.
Like that.
Oh, so the micro units are a lower number, and I'm seeing 26, which also is moderate.
Weight.
But we give you a scale on the side so you can get a sense of how good or bad the number is. And the most important thing people can do is put this in their home, check it out from the library or buy one, and leave it for a week and build an intuition for what the numbers are like throughout the week in the nighttime when you're sleeping. And we've had people even in Pittsburgh put it in their child's room and realize that, oh, my goodness, my child has asthma. I've been putting an air conditioning box in their window to make it better, and it's making it worse.
B, how much do these cost?
$200 each plus shipping and tax.
Not a terribly exorbitant price, especially when you consider the potential health benefits of having something like this.
Correct.
Let's go to Ron in Pittsburgh. Ron, thank you for waiting. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very concerned about the Cheswick and Neville Island and McKeesport plants. That's one's coal fire power plant in Springdale, Cheswick. The others are coke plants. And I want to point out that solar energy and other renewables provide many more jobs than coal does. And lastly, I'd like to say that the readings have been taken in Pittsburgh. The mapping that Dr. Albert Presto of Carnegie Mellon has done shows that this part of the country is way worse in terms of particulates than most other areas of the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron, for the call.
Ron, that's a really good set of points, actually. Let me just talk about Neville Island first. We have a lot of work we're doing with ACAN, Allegheny County Clean Air Now, which is actually a neighborhood group dedicated to improving the air in that region. And they're doing all sorts of measurements. They're using SUMA canisters. They're using specs. They're using professional devices. And they're even working with the Allegheny County Health Department when they can. But this fundamental issue of inequality and what Albert Presta did is really powerful. He looked at black carbon across our region, and he made a map, an interactive map that shows how bad the air quality is in different parts of our region. When you look in the river valleys, when you look at places like Avalon or Braddock or Hazelwood, it's terrible. Compared to what? Compared to the high points, places like Fox Chapel. And when you overlay that same picture with income levels, what you see is a reality that's very depressing, which is the poorest regions across Pittsburgh have the worst air, which means they have shorter lifespans, arrhythmia, cardiovascular disease, and asthma. And that's the reality of how we are distributing air quality in Pittsburgh today.
B. Dias, as far as the knowledge that someone needs to have who is in possession of one of these devices, how much do they need to know about air quality and contaminants? What knowledge base do they would be most helpful in order to use this monitor, or does it not matter?
Well, the nice thing we hope they'll get from the monitor is you don't have to know anything when you get it. But once you get it, the idea is you start experimenting and exploring and learning more about what's in your home environment. For example, when I first got a spec in our kitchen and I saw the number spike, I turned on the ventilation above the stove and I didn't realize that it made the air worse. And it was because, one, I hadn't cleaned the filters in 5 years. And two, I discovered that the air wasn't venting outside. It was just venting upstairs into my child's bedroom. So I discovered this through using the spec. Otherwise, I didn't really know anything about HVAC systems or ventilation. So this is an instrument that helps you discover things in your home and really take action based on the knowledge you're gaining. And it's kind of fun to experiment. You follow the air trajectory and like, okay, is it going upstairs? All right, the readings are really bad in the child's room and I'm cooking, so let's ventilate it better and open this window, open that door. Does it get worse? Does it get better? That's the kind of little experiment as we want to create in everybody's homes so that they can explore on their own and be empowered to really change the way they breathe.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the air quality monitors that have been devised at CMU's CREATE Lab. We are with Carnegie Mellon University robotics professor, Dr. Ela Norbash, as well as B. Dias, who does all of the outreach for the CREATE Lab. 412-246-2002, the number to call to join our conversation. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Dave in South Park. Dave, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. Welcome.
Oh, yes. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered what kind of uniform response the device has as a function of particle size and or chemistry of the particles that it's measuring and what relationship this might have to adverse health effects.
Good question.
Dave, that's a very good question. This particle detector is most sensitive between about 0.3 microns and about 2.5 microns, right, roughly PM2.5. And across that range, it's roughly equally sensitive, and then it drops off really quickly. So in English, those are particles that are small enough that they can embed themselves in your lungs and get through to your bloodstream. In terms of volatiles and other ways to detect what kind of particle it is, we're going to be starting some research at Carnegie Mellon. We've been fundraising to be able to do that. And the dream is to design chips that can actually detect things like benzene and really help you identify the kind of particles that you're breathing. But if you look at the epidemiological reports that folks like Harvard put out, and that, you know, there's a big report on India, the country of India, they have such high particle rates that 50% of the population has 4.5 years of less lifespan now today just because of the air pollution.
That is
that's
terrible.
It's horrible, and it's all linked directly to this number, to basically the micrograms of the weight of ultrafine particles in the air.
What can people do with the numbers, the information that they record? Can they report that to? Is there a central database that they can report those numbers to that can be used to help devise some sort of a plan of action?
So locally, of course, they can take actions like opening and closing their windows, buying an air filter at a place like Target and putting it in their child's bedroom and closing the door so it's a small space so the air filter has a chance, changing your cooking oil, things like that. The data all goes over a Wi-Fi network up to an open source repository we've designed at Carnegie Mellon. So all your data lives there, and you own the data yourself, and you can choose to share it with whomever you like. So neighborhoods can get together and really measure their air together in an indoor environment. But there's no good reporting facility yet for connecting that to governmental organizations like the health department, because the health department kind of stops at your door. What they care about is regulating the sources of air, like Shenango, and dealing with the outside air quality.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Benjamin in Carrick. Benjamin, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me on. I'm a veteran who has served time in Afghanistan and worked around something called a burn pit. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of that, but it's where military bases burn all their refuse.
Wow.
And it obviously creates a lot of particulates. And I was wondering what sort of application or insight you would have on your device being used in a situation like that, and what sort of things a person can do on their air. I know you mentioned air filters, but what can someone do to reduce those particulates or even just making them?
Benjamin, that's a really interesting question. And burn pits are a bit of a disaster. Both in rural Pennsylvania, we see those. And, of course, we see wood-burning stoves, outdoor stoves. And with the thing to remember about a burn pit that the military uses or in rural PA is that it flows like water in a river. Basically, it hugs the ground. And so the valleys are affected, and it just goes right through the valleys like the fingers of a hand. What you can do with it is you can imagine ringing things like the mess hall, the bunks where people are sleeping, and see if, depending on the direction of the wind, if the burn pit particulates are going away from base or heading right into the base. And you can get those exposure readings. It has a little mode where you can see the historical readings on the screen of the spec. What you can do about it, of course, when you're working right at the burn pit is you should be wearing a respirator. There's no doubt about that. But the more dangerous issue is all those people who are sleeping an eighth of a mile away are breathing this stuff all night long.
And who don't know necessarily.
That's right.
But they're going to feel the health effects later, aren't they, B?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, when you're sleeping, you're still breathing in all the particulates that are inside your home. That's why it's really nice to be able to monitor it and understand what's going on when you're not awake and when you're not at home, for example. Is the air quality getting bad at a particular hour? There was one incident where a person had the speck in his home, and when he left the house, they noticed, looking at the historical data, that every afternoon there was a spike. And they discovered that it's because of the construction that was next door. And so they were able to identify the source and maybe take action, talk to the neighbor. Okay, you know, we're feeling the effects of your construction. Can we shield it better, you know, and do things to remediate the problem?
Is there a common bit of feedback that you're getting from people or just, you know, more and more people finding out about this and contacting you as a result, as the word of this spreads throughout the community?
We're seeing a lot of interest, actually, internationally. We get orders from Sweden, from Australia, you name it.
Oftentimes they'll say, I need one right now. How can I get it suited? So, and that's part of the reason we spun off the company, is because as a lab, we can't really produce so many to serve everybody. So one avenue is the company and being able to sell it and produce it in mass and bulk value, bulk numbers. And the other option is to put it in the libraries. And that's worked out really nicely, where we can make it affordable to folks who don't want to buy it or can't afford to buy it. So that's really nice. And it involves the library as a community space where people can potentially come together and talk about air quality and take action collectively.
We have an email from Jeff in the South Hills. He says there is a lot of wood smoke in my neighborhood at times, especially on weekends, from fire pits in the area. It even sometimes fills the inside of the house. Would these devices detect this?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
It's interesting. People think if I smoke on my front stoop, my daughter in her bedroom upstairs won't be inhaling the smoke.
Oy.
Boy, do you learn something when you put the speck in her room and you go smoke outside. And
because
you realize
that smoke rises, right?
It rises exactly. And infiltrates right through the window, like magic, as if the window is just a sponge. And absolutely, if you have wood smoke that you can smell outside, your air in your house is being hit by that. And you have to start thinking about closing your door to your bedroom and sticking a purifier in your bedroom. And when I say purifier, we're not talking, you know, ozone or ionic purifiers. We're talking about a HEPA filter in a proper device that's sucking air through a HEPA filter and pushing clean air back out the other side.
But that's, and it's a great suggestion, but it's kind of a Band-Aid in the broader picture.
Right.
What do we need to do about this? We've identified a real problem here. So what needs to happen next?
So we need to recognize it as a public health crisis, which it is. A quarter of all emergency room cases are asthma. It's insane. My daughter used to cough every night going to bed, and I thought it was just a lingering cold until I finally figured out that if I put a filter in the room, she stops coughing. Mm. We need to recognize that it's a public health crisis, and then as a society, we have to decide that we can't let diesel trucks and Shenango Cookworks and all the other sources in the world just not compute the external cost, the externality of all that air quality and the quality of life impact it has on us people. And we have to decide as a society we actually care about this. And up till now, we've let basically individual corporations make their own decision and find loopholes through government regulation instead of thinking about societal externality.
And haven't we done that? And I think about this, and you just got me to thinking about something that really emanates from growing up here, which I did here in Pittsburgh. And I remember, you know, when the steel industry was going full bore. And in this part of town, you had Jones and Lachlan on the river belching that stuff 24/7 and other mills. And the air here was much worse than it is now. So one thought is, how much worse was it back then? And maybe we just don't even want to know at this point. We probably do. And, you know, somebody's got the data somewhere and we're probably all, as we age, are afraid to look at it. But we cleaned up a lot of that. So, A, if we were able to do that, why can't we do it again? And B, how much better, as bad as it is the air now than it was, say, in the 70s?
And the sort of bumper sticker we all need to have is that, yeah, the air is better than it was. It was terrible before, and now it's bad.
We went from terrible to bad. All right.
We're the second worst in the entire United States. We have more than 200 days a year, 200 days a year, where our air is unhealthy. And so it's much better than it was, but the problem is we can't use that as an excuse to sit on our tushes and stop acting. And we have to act if we want our children to not have long-term chronic diseases that impact them.
So one small step for man, and that is these air quality monitors and BDIAS. Again, for people who might have tuned in late and want to get one, before we wrap this up very quickly, what do they need to do if they want one?
Yeah, just go to specsensor.com. That's specsensor.com. And you can buy one online and ask us questions if you have any.
Thanks again to our guests, Dr. Ilan Orbash, who is a Carnegie Mellon University robotics professor, and B. Dias, who does the outreach for the CREATE Lab. It was the CREATE Lab that created the air quality monitors that the Carnegie Libraries have received and other people in the community. We have one here now in our brand new studio. Congratulations to both of you, by the way, for being the first in-person guests in our new studio here for Essential Pittsburgh at the Community Broadcast Center.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, contributor Rebecca Harris looks at mobile businesses. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
They had these machines that drove the in-and-out breathing. I mean, it just kept them alive.
In 1949, Dr. Julius Jungner moved to Pittsburgh to help develop a vaccine for polio. The University of Pittsburgh lab where he worked, directed by Dr. Jonas Salk, was located below a ward of polio patients who couldn't breathe without the help of machines, iron lungs.
Everybody was very serious about what we were doing. I never worked so hard in my life.
Polio is caused by a virus that lives in the throat and intestine. It attacks the nervous system and can result in paralysis. Children are most at risk. Throughout the 1940s and 50s, prevalence of the disease only increased.
People were hysterically afraid of it.
So much so that they sought any protection. When he was a boy, Jungner's grandmother used to tie a cake of camphor around his neck when he went out to play.
What she didn't know is that when I left the house, I would take the thing off and put it in the mailbox. But she was convinced for the rest of her life that she had kept me from getting polio. And that was nice.
Years later, Jungner developed a cell culture method that sped up the vaccine's creation by growing millions and millions of cells, which meant more and faster testing.
This was a complete break with the old guard.
The Salk Lab in its entirety was a break with familiar wisdom. It aimed to develop a killed vaccine, one in which the virus was inactivated.
Live virus vaccines had always been the ones that worked.
The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, now the March of Dimes Foundation, funded the Salk Lab while simultaneously supporting Albert Sabin, who was working on a live vaccine. Jungner says by 1952, the Salk Lab had demonstrated its vaccine could produce an immune response.
What was needed to really make the vaccine acceptable was to do something called a phase 3 trial. In 1954, there were 800,000 children in the United States that participated. What they did then was just wait for the summer and see what would happen.
The trial proved the vaccine's efficacy, and it went into widespread use in 1955. By 1979, polio was eradicated in the United States.
My name is Kelly Stefano Cole. I'm the associate director of the Regional Biocontainment Laboratory.
Stefano Cole says developing a vaccine today is very different. It can take more than 10 years for one to be approved for use in the general population.
We want to be absolutely sure that it's safe. We ask one question, get the answer, ask the next question.
But viruses themselves aren't getting any more straightforward. Stefano Cole says pathogens, and the people who carry them, are mixing faster than ever before. Meanwhile, diseases kept at bay by standard vaccination can easily resurge.
It only takes one or two children or one or two adults introduced into the population and enough people not vaccinated to just bring that epidemic back again.
Polio persists in Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, all of which had been using Sabin's live oral vaccine, but recently switched to the Salk Lab's injectable killed vaccine. There is no cure for the disease. It can only be prevented. To have helped develop that prevention, says Youngner, is the kind of thrill few people ever have.
It was a moment of complete and total enthusiasm and pride.
For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Movable businesses are, for lack of a better description, on the move. Whether it's medical services, pet grooming, or food trucks, varieties of mobile businesses are popping up around the country. This week, contributor Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looks at mobile businesses. Greetings, Rebecca.
Hello, Paul. It's nice to be here with you.
And let's talk about these mobile food trucks. They are hugely popular in Pittsburgh.
Right. So we have mobile businesses in general and the business of movable businesses. So food trucks is a huge subset of that. But when you look at the market in its entirety, we're seeing everything from portable car wash services, hair salons, pet grooming vans, clothing stores on wheels. So
I've not seen much of this at all. This is happening in Pittsburgh?
This is happening in Pittsburgh. I mean, there are so many mobile businesses popping up. And this
Who's doing this? Everybody.
I mean, really everybody. There's trucks that are happening. We have trucks here. We have trucks around the country. And it's really become a whole new wave. Literally, I had a movable pet cutting hair salon come to my house this past week to trim and groom my dogs because we had gotten these dogs when they were older, a couple years old, and we don't know what had happened to them prior to that, but they had really a tough time when you take them to groomers. So a woman came to our house, picked up our dogs, took them outside into her amazing van. It's kind of like nicer than my house, this van, and groomed the dogs. And it's really convenience and cost. And so while some of the services are really convenient, they might cost a little bit more, but the time that you save, it's becoming a growing trend.
Well, time is money.
Time is money.
So let me just get this straight now. What kind of dogs are these?
These are schnauzers, and they grow hair like people, like you and me, and so they have to be groomed. And many people have, you know, similar dogs. So this is a huge business. And how about portable hair salons for people, Paul?
Well, I mean, that would seem to be
a bigger market.
You know, if you get a pizza delivered to your house, you're expected to provide a tip. But I'm guessing it's much more expensive to have somebody come and do your hair at your house.
Well, and they actually don't do it in your house. They do it in their truck, because what happens is the trucks are fitted and licensed as regular businesses. And that's really the key to this whole operation. So when we talk about the food trucks, and I think people are really familiar with food trucks, by 2017, food trucks will generate about $2.7 billion in revenue, which is an incredible number. And that's here just in the United States. And that is really fourfold over what we were seeing in 2012, according to the National Restaurant Association. And what's happening with food trucks is they're really starting to look at themselves as lean tech startups. They're focusing on rapid prototyping, business flexibility, cash and resources and conversion and market trends. And so these food trucks are following the same trends we're seeing in regular brick and mortar businesses, in tech businesses, and businesses that we're just seeing in general. And that's a very interesting concept.
And is this a relatively new thing, especially when it comes to food trucks? Because years ago, I mean, if you wanted a food truck, you had Mr. Softy, and that was about maybe like a guy that had coffee.
Right, and the ice cream truck. Remember the old ice cream truck, and you heard ding-a-ling-a-ling in the different songs, and you'd run after the ice cream truck.
Way before my time.
Way before your time, Paul. No, this is really a whole different model. These trucks can actually test new products real-time with daily menus. They have huge social media pushes. The average customer interviewed through this study through the American Restaurant Association was spending close to $10 at lunch, $15 at dinner. This is really food on the move. This is not just a hamburger or a hot dog at a truck vendor. It's a much different concept.
Well when Ernest Hemingway wrote A Movable Feast, I don't think he was talking about food trucks.
No.
So in the last few years, the food truck business, as we've said, has taken off. So why? are we seeing such a large growth in this segment?
So we're really seeing the demand coming. Younger people are seeing this as a way to really enjoy different aspects of unique foods. They're quick. They're easy. We're seeing everything from fresh vegan to double-decker pizzerias. I mean, it's a very strong trend. And taking meals, you know, to the street is a very inventive way for restaurant owners to test and bring their dishes straight to the source. Reasonable pricing. And so it's a way of really taking the products to the people.
Did we identify how much more it might cost for, and you know, if you're going to the food truck or any truck that's providing some sort of service, that's one thing. If the truck is coming to you, how much more does it cost the consumer than going to a brick-and-mortar business that does the same service?
Right. Well, when we looked at some of these different options, in some ways they might balance out because the owner of the truck, for example, a groomer and a hair groomer, that person, that woman or man, is not going to have the overhead that they would normally have in a brick-and-mortar store. They really just have a truck. And you can buy a trailer, a basic trailer truck for $10,000. Now, you're going to have to outfit it with all the things that you need on the inside. But so some of the costs are saved and passed on to customers. I read a story about a very unique clothing truck, and the woman was able to basically set up a retail clothing operation in New York City in one of these trucks and was able to charge very reasonable rates for the clothes, and it was vintage clothing because she didn't have the overhead of renting a store in New York City.
Right, but let's say, again, somebody who's either grooming your pets or coming to your house to cut your hair. My guess is it's one customer at a time that way. You're not in a place where you can have multiple customers. So how does that business model work? Does it cost that much more for the individual based on the convenience?
I think that you might see some upcharges along those lines. But again, the owner of the business does not have to turn 10 customers because, in general, their overhead for the month is so much less than it would be if they had a store. Mm. And that's where you're seeing the differences. Absolutely.
And from permits to insurance, there must be legal restrictions and limitations to selling products out of a truck. So what can you tell us about that?
We don't want our listeners to go out and buy a truck and set up business right away. You will need to, it's a business, even though it's mobile, you have to treat it like a business. You need permits, you need business licenses, you need vendor permits, you need insurance. Those are some of the mandatory prerequisites. If you're selling certain types of products that generate a lot of trash, you have to have certain size trash containers. Vendors who are actually producing food can't create smoke or strong odors through the preparation of the food. There are things like signage. There's the size of the signage that's allowed, but you might not be able to put signage on the street next to you that's huge. That would be considered acceptable, and certain parking restrictions. So in many ways, you have to do your homework when you're looking at getting into the truck market.
And as far as the future of this, you're saying it's really taking hold here in Pittsburgh?
It really is. Here's some of the ones that we found in Pittsburgh. There's Easy Auto Wash, which is one of best in the burg. And what they do is they come to your car, they wash your car without water. They have a whole system where they wash it with sponges and special sprays and everything else, and they can go to your parking spot during the day. So I think that really that's the kind of thing. We see lots of fashion trucks, Roadie and the Vintage Valet and Style Truck and Broke Little Rich Girl. Unbelievable. There's an ultrasound truck that can actually go into different neighborhoods, and people can go have ultrasound scans. And a sweet Bella Christie's boutique. And the pop shop. So those are just a few of the really unique ones, along with the taco truck. We can't forget that.
So you see this. You see this sticking with us for a while.
I think this particular trend.
Rebecca Harris, Director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looking at mobile businesses in Pittsburgh. As always, Rebecca, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tune in tomorrow for our special Earth Day program. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.